morning, and may it please the court. I'm Charles Cooper for the appellants, the National Rifle Association, and three of its members who are individual named plaintiffs. Federal law prohibits all federally licensed firearms dealers from selling handguns and handgun ammunition to law-abiding adults between the ages of 18 and 20, and it thus bars this class of adults from the entire commercial handgun market. The particular statute, 922B1, we submit, violates the Second Amendment rights of the plaintiffs and other law-abiding, responsible 18 to 20-year-old adults. We think this answer, this proposition follows unequivocally from Heller and from the text and the history of the Second Amendment itself. In Heller, the Supreme Court stressed that constitutional rights are enshrined with the scope they were understood to have when they were adopted by the people, whether or not future legislators or even future judges believe that that scope is too broad. Now, this case, admittedly, will test that proposition for some judges, but there is simply no doubt at all that 18 to 20-year-olds were universally understood to be within the scope of the Second Amendment's protections when the Second Amendment was adopted by the people. This follows from two basic propositions. The first one is this: the animating purpose of the Second Amendment, according to the Heller Court, the reason that it was codified in the Bill of Rights itself, was to prevent elimination of the militia. The Supreme Court then in McDonald reaffirmed this proposition quite emphatically, saying adoption of the Second Amendment was prompted by fear that the federal government would disarm the militia. It follows, if these things are true, that the subset of the people, the right of the people to keep and bear arms, the subset of the people that comprised the militia, at a minimum, were understood at the time of the founding to have a right to keep and bear arms. And we know, and this is the second point in my syllogism I'm offering you this morning, and we know from the history of the Second Amendment that 18, in fact, able-bodied males between the ages of 18 and 45 were specifically part of the organized militia, because the Militia Act of 1792 specifically defined the organized militia as all such able-bodied male inhabitants. And that statute didn't just require that they be enrolled in the militia. It required that they arm themselves. They were required by law to be armed with a good musket or firelock or rifle. At the same time,
there were state laws in effect.
Yes, Your Honor.
At the time.
Yes.
That in some states that required the parents of these children to children. If you have them in that age bracket, you think of them as children. That required the parents of these 18 to 21-year-olds to furnish the arms if they were to serve in the militia.
That's right. That's
to the young, to the 18 to 20-year-olds. So,
Judge King, that's right.
Not entirely in support of what you were saying.
Well, on the contrary, I would suggest to you that it is, Judge King, because every state, at the time of the ratification of the Second Amendment, also defined its own militia to include at least 18-year-olds and above. Some of them defined the militia to include 16-year-olds and above. But the ones, Your Honor, those that required that the parent
provide the arms.
Keep in mind, no statute at the time interfered in any way with the 18-year-olds, 18 to 20-year-olds' ability or right to buy a weapon himself or herself. But to be sure, some of these militia statutes did require that parents equip minors, at the time minors, no longer, but at the time minors between the ages of 18 and 20, with the necessary equipment. Only those 18 to 20-year-olds that were under the care and custody, every one of those statutes say that if the individual is under the care and custody of their parents, then the parent is obligated to do it. And keep this in mind, and this is important. At that time, these were minors. They are no longer, and that's another part of my argument in a moment. But
well, finish your sentence, because I have a question about that.
Okay. But they were minors at the time, and until age 21, their parents, as long as they were under their care and custody, were entitled to their income from their labors and their services. The parents in the common law was entitled to a child's wages and income and services. So it made a lot of sense that those state laws would say, well, if the individual doesn't have entitlement to his own wherewithal to equip himself with these arms, then the parents will be obligated to do it.
Okay, let me, because this kind of drives my question as well, and I will tell you in the interest of full disclosure, when I turned 21, I was a second year in law school, so I completely get the angst of the 18 to 20-year-old not having all the rights of someone else. But I'm wondering if, I mean, historically we have had throughout the last 200-300 years a range of age at which people get to do what we might call adult things, drive, vote, consent to sex, marry, drink alcohol, buy cigarettes, go to a casino, buy a gun. And that range has been somewhere from mid-teens to 21. If that's our historical range for when we give license to what we might call children, young people, whatever we want to call them, to do X through, you know, A through Z, why is this really any different?
Well, Your Honor, first of all, whatever the case may have been, and up until the late 60s, it was true that in most places the age of majority still was 21. But that is no longer the case. Now, in the overwhelming, all of the states except for two that still have a 21-year-old age of majority, the age of majority is less than 21, 18,
but
essentially.
But there's still different ages at which you can do different things.
And like what?
Drink, buy alcohol, sell alcohol to someone, enter a casino in Nevada, buy cigarettes in some states. You know, I'm not saying these are things we want people to do. I'm simply saying that they're things that there are age limits on that are something other than 18. We also have lower ages for, say, driving in some states, or consent to sex, or marrying without parents' permission, et cetera. My point is more, if we're going to look at this historically, then historically we have had this range at which children become adults for various things, and they get a license to do something they couldn't have done at a younger age, or their ability to do something. And I'm asking, why is that not the analysis here?
Because Heller and McDonald insist that the history you look at is the history at the time that the Second Amendment
was ratified. See, I don't see Heller as insisting that at all. Heller said, you know, in fact said the militia thing was an explanation of why they cared, but not, because if we're just going to say militia, then we have to look at the weapons that they had in the militia then, and that's all you could buy if you were 18. And obviously they weren't saying that. They said that tells us that was the reason, but that doesn't stop us from saying handguns can't be just, you know, banned. And that was very important in Heller. And in fact, they look to statutes and cases thereafter for Justice Scalia's understanding.
And they were very specific, Judge Haynes, very specific to say that the most important history to look at is the history at the time of the actual founding, the actual ratification of the of the constitutional provision at issue, and that, yes, you can look at how that provision was applied in the aftermath of its ratification to determine what the people, what is the issue, what is the key question that is before this court. Well, that is, as the Supreme Court said in Heller, that is what is the scope that the people understood this amendment to have at the time they adopted
well,
it. Not today.
Is it clear that the people in that time, okay, if they wanted you to be at 18 in the militia with your parents giving you a rifle, is that the same thing as having a handgun when you're 19 and not in the militia? I mean, if we're going to get into the militia analysis and the people's view of that, today an 18-year-old can be in the militia and possess whatever firearm is appropriate for their performance of their duties. Today an 18-year-old, there's no bar on selling a rifle or a long gun to an 18-year-old. It is the handgun. I think Heller's very clear. Handguns are important. I'm not arguing that at all. I'm very much in favor of that. My problem is if we're going to look at the people in the 1700s, the people today still have these range of ages where people get to do things. If this were a law that said 30-year-olds, you can't sell it to 30-year-olds, I don't think we'd all be here. This would not be a difficult case.
But this is that case, Your Honor.
That's the
this
question. To that me, case. That's the question.
This, and,
me.
And,
I can't speak for anybody
this
else.
Is, and this is my submission to you.
Okay.
This is that case. First of all, regardless of what today's age of majority is and when it is that an individual becomes emancipated from his parents and required to care and protect him or herself, regardless of that, my initial point, and I think dispositive one, is that the history of the founding of the Second Amendment, the ratification of the Second Amendment, just that's the end of the case because, as Heller itself said, the enshrinement of constitutional rights necessarily takes certain policy issues off the table, off the table. Now, this issue was off the table in 1792, but even apart from that, Judge Haynes, today, 18 to 20-year-olds are adults, fully emancipated from their parents. They have to care for themselves, and their rights under the Second Amendment, are not a bit different in scope or content than any other adults. Would we say that
now, in Heller, the Supreme Court recognized that certain categories of people could be restricted, the felon, yes, mentally ill persons, yes, and historically, these people maybe with weapons might be a dangerous situation, and there were similar concerns by Congress that saying people between 18 and 21 with handguns could be dangerous. What distinguishes applying the Heller situation of these categories of people and restricting people between 18 and 21 similar to felons and people that are mentally ill? I mean, there's still a way to get around it. Their parents can buy them guns, but there's some restrictions. It's not a total restriction, but is there some distinction or some difference as to why we can restrict someone that's mentally ill and someone that's a felon but not an individual between 18 and 21?
Yes, Your Honor. With respect to the longstanding, as the court called it, restriction on felons owning guns, and certainly on the people who are mentally ill, those restrictions find their antecedents, their lineal ancestors, in the history of the time. Either that, or the record of the history of the founding is silent on them. For example, in the Heller 2 case before the D.C. Circuit, where they upheld registration, where there was no history at the time for registration, so the record was silent on it. But when you look at the record of the founding and the ratification of the Second Amendment, it's not at all silent on this question. It's overwhelming. There is nothing supporting the proposition that someone 18 years of age who is able-bodied and male could not buy a weapon. He was by law required to, by law. And so, that's the answer to that, Your Honor. It's not, the Supreme Court said when these exceptions come before us, there'll be time enough to look at their historical justifications.
And the historical justification has to go how far back? Are you saying to the time that the Second Amendment was adopted?
Not necessarily, but I'm saying this one does. This one does. Unequivocally so. And again, as the court said, this is a policy issue on which there was simply no debate in 1791 and 1792. And so it was taken off the table, even though it has controversial public safety implications. Make no mistake, but in McDonald, the majority addressed specifically that point. They said, well, it's true, it does. Incorporating the Second Amendment as against the states fully has, we understand its controversial public safety implications. But that's true for many constitutional rights, many constitutional rights. And judicial faithfulness to implementing those constitutional rights can't bend in light of those concerns, or we wouldn't have an exclusionary rule.
I think your time's up, but I don't think we really. To me, in my head, it's whether an 18-year-old is the same as a 30-year-old is kind of my very simplistic starting point.
And if I am allowed to come back on my rebuttal time, I'll address that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Anisha Dasgupta representing the appellees. I'd like to begin with Judge Haynes's question about the difference between 18-year-olds and 30-year-olds. The common law, like our society today, recognizes that persons under 21 are still in the process of maturing. And the common law drew that line all the way up to the age of 21. Heller and this court, the Supreme Court in Heller, and this court have both explained that, like other rights, the individual right secured by the Second Amendment is not unlimited, and it can be subject to regulations that are reasonable and not inconsistent with the right as historically understood. And this court has noted that such regulations include restrictions on possession by young persons to whom the common law did not historically provide the full status of adulthood. Persons under 21 years old fall into that category. Now, the Supreme Court in Heller, in recognizing an individual right to bear arms, also recognized that handguns, in certain contexts, pose particular public safety concerns because of their easy concealability. And the Supreme Court noted that the Constitution permits some methods for addressing these concerns, including qualifications and conditions on commercial sales. The laws at issue here accord with these legal and historical understandings by creating a graduated scheme for commercial firearm sales. Persons under 18 are not permitted to purchase firearms, but they can possess them under certain circumstances. Persons aged 18 to 21 can purchase shotguns, other kinds of long guns, but they're not permitted to purchase handguns. However, they can possess both long guns and handguns. So the situation is not by any means a ban on handgun possession.
Reminds me of graduated driver's license. Like, you start out with your parents in the front seat, and then you can drive your sister, and then you can drive a stranger as you get older. It almost seems that way with the guns. Maybe that's not how Congress intended it.
Well, Congress acknowledged that individuals mature at different rates, and that there may be some individuals who are mature enough to possess and use handguns whose families and other responsible adults understand those individuals to be mature enough and are in a position to provide them with handguns and enable them to acquire training and undertake other activities related to those handguns. Congress's concern was that persons under 21, both legally and scientifically, you know, in our society, we recognize they're still in the process of maturing. They sometimes engage in impulsive behaviors. During the hearings that led to the passage of this legislation, Congress heard testimony from law enforcement officers all around the country, from cities like New York, Chicago, Atlanta, St. Louis. And what Congress learned was that there were multiple jurisdictions that sought to restrict firearm possession by individuals under 21 and other persons whose interests might not be in the public interest, and that the commercial sales market was such that those states were not able to enforce their own laws. Individuals were able to use mail order sales, they were able to cross state lines, they were able to use means to circumvent the law and to be involved in violent crime. And Congress determined that because the locus of the problem, it was a problem of commercial sales specifically, of federally licensed firearms dealers who often, in the course of the commercial transaction, weren't able to verify the age of the individual or the maturity. So Congress focused the scheme on acquisition through certain channels. Congress recognized that there may be legitimate reasons why persons 18 to 21 might possess handguns and that it might not pose a public safety problem. And Congress constructed this scheme to allow for that. So,
historically, how far back can we go to say that there's been some sort of restrictions, if any, on minors as far as purchasing firearms? Is there a history in this country of those types of restrictions? And if so, how far back can we go to find those types of restrictions?
Well, Your Honor, the historical record, especially with laws governing commercial sales, is inconclusive at best, in part because there are so many different categories of individual who the law treated differently based on their family circumstances. With respect to persons under 21, however, the law recognized that they were not full adults, and so even in contexts where they might freely have access to firearms, like militia service, they weren't invariably understood to be able to enter into those contexts without the consent of their parents. So,
now wait a minute, I didn't hear you. They were not able to do that without the consent of their parents, is what you said.
They were not invariably understood. So the laws in different jurisdictions were different. I understand my opposing counsel cites to you the text of the 1792 Militia Act. Well, the 1792 Militia Act provides that every free and able-bodied white male citizen of the respective states who is or shall be of the ages 18 and under the age of 45, except as is hereinafter accepted, shall severally and respectively be enrolled in the militia. So the next section, which deals with that exception, provides that persons who now are or may hereafter be exempted by the laws of the respective states shall be and are hereby exempted from militia duty, notwithstanding their being above the age of 18. So the Militia Act itself recognized that in certain states, individuals under the age of 21 were not necessarily considered part of the militia, and to the extent that they wished to enroll in militia service, the state law provided that they needed their parents' consent. So this notion of a transitional age where one may be able to do certain things with respect to firearms but not others is not a new concept at all. It has a robust historical grounding to it. The historical authorities that support it are the types of sources and authorities that the Supreme Court looked to in Heller. And as Judge Haynes pointed out earlier, to the extent that history provides a limiting principle, we really would be in a different situation altogether if this law addressed 30-year-olds rather than persons who, under the common law, were simply not considered adults, and still today are not considered adults invariably in every context, especially where risk and public safety are at issue.
So this case, I mean, as I understand it, in order to decide this case, we have to go back and do very careful historical research on how males between the ages of 18 mm-hmm. and 21 were viewed at the time of the founding in terms of their right to possess guns, their right to buy guns, and so on. And I'm not saying, I don't necessarily subscribe to Judge Kavanaugh's view of the world, but we certainly, no matter what view we take, we have to go back and get a very careful assessment of what the situation was at the founding.
Well, Your Honor, history is certainly relevant, but Heller tells us that the relevant historical sources don't end at the time of the finding.
You also have to look at the period after the founding, which will tell you how people viewed the situation then at the time of the founding.
That's indeed true, Your Honor. So courts of appeals in the aftermath of Heller have recognized that Heller itself laid out certain basic principles but didn't provide an exhaustive framework for analyzing the scope of the Second Amendment right. So, for example, the Seventh Circuit in its in-bank decision in Scoyan said that looking at Heller's analysis, particularly the categories of regulation that Heller deemed presumptively reasonable, tell us that the legislative role didn't end in 1791 because, for example, some of the presumptively reasonable categories, such as felons, restrictions on felons or persons with mental incapacities, are the product of the late 19th century or even in some cases, the early 20th century. So courts of appeals, in reading Heller's language within the context of the regulations that Heller described as being presumptively reasonable, has noted that Heller there may have determined that those types of restrictions, which include conditions and qualifications on commercial sales, may pass constitutional muster either because of their longstanding nature, where Heller obviously conceived of longstanding as being something that means something more than just at the time of the framing, or secondarily, Heller may have viewed those as the type of regulations that might pass constitutional muster under heightened scrutiny, for example, intermediate scrutiny. And so courts of appeals have occasionally assumed arguendo that the Second Amendment right was implicated and proceeded directly to the heightened scrutiny analysis. Here, it's the government's position that history demonstrates that these particular individuals, and especially the right of commercial purchase that they're seeking to exercise, fell outside the scope of the Second Amendment right as historically understood. But even assuming arguendo that the Second Amendment right would be implicated, these laws clearly pass constitutional muster under heightened scrutiny because of the careful way in which Congress tailored the scheme, that is to ensure that possession would be possible, that use under supervision would be possible, but that the locus of the problem, the commercial firearm sale by an individual who may not be in a position to determine the responsibility or maturity of the buyer, that would be something that for public safety reasons, it's necessary to address.
Let me ask you this. We were talking about, you know, what the people understood in 1792 about firearm sales. Are we limited to that thinking, in other words, to the question of firearm sales, or can we look at the larger question of how society viewed when you became an adult for law purposes, understanding, again, we all mature at different ages, and, you know, some people don't grow up till they're 30 or 40 or ever, and some people are quite mature at 15 or 16. We get that. The law can't, as you say, and I think everybody agrees, can't make those determinations person by person, so they use age as a proxy. That general concept of what that age as a proxy was, can we look at that beyond the firearm context, or are we limited to the firearm context when we're looking to the past?
Well, the court certainly can look beyond the firearm context. For example, in Emerson, the court noted the historical notion of infancy and the fact that persons who under the common law would have been considered infants were historically restricted, particularly in the firearm context. But outside of the firearm context, too, what's at stake in this case is whether the historical understanding of the Second Amendment is such that it would be inconsistent with the regulation on possession of persons 18 to 21. And historically, the framers would not have understood persons who were 18 years old to be fully adults, exercising full rights of adulthood in all contexts. And in fact, our society today does not either. So there's no incongruity here. What there is there's a continuum and tradition of legislative decision-making here within particular constitutional boundaries. Congress has determined, based on the evidence before it at the time that this legislation was enacted, that the type of concerns that Congress detected from a public safety standpoint were not able to be addressed through other means. And again, coming back to what this scheme is, it is a regulation on acquisition through certain commercial channels. It is not a ban on possession.
I do think we understand that. I did have one other question, may not be relevant, but given this focus on the militia by your opponent, and understanding that to me, Heller very much goes past that, but focusing on the militia, was a handgun or the equivalent of pistol revolver a typical weapon of an organized militia in the 1700s?
It would not have been, Your Honor. Obviously, Heller looks to the fact that a handgun is the preferred means of self-defense now, but at the time of the founding, Heller...
I don't think they can have it both ways on saying we have to, because they could be in the militia, that means they should own a handgun, because I think Justice Scalia went well beyond the militia issue. I agree with that. But just if we're going to look at the militia as being sort of determinative, to me, a militia weapon from the 1700s is a rifle or the equivalent. So I'm sorry, I interrupted you. Go ahead.
Yes, Your Honor, that's entirely correct. And in fact, to extend the militia analogy to the present day, it's true that 18 to 20-year-olds do serve in the military today, but even in the context of the military, handgun use is very closely regulated. So there's a big difference between talking about the ability of someone to use a handgun within a highly disciplined, closely supervised military environment, and talking, again, we're not talking about possession, we're talking about the ability of someone in that age to freely purchase in a commercial context from a commercial retailer who may be set up in ways that there aren't safeguards to guard against impulsive purchasing, to take care of how that handgun that's purchased is maintained after it's been purchased. So there are some very real and important distinctions here that Congress attempted to take account of when enacting this law and devising this scheme.
You might have covered it I apologize if you did, but what's the government's position with regard to the level of scrutiny that should be applied in this situation? Intermediate, strict, or where do we stand on this particular?
If the court elects to apply heightened scrutiny, at most intermediate scrutiny. Strict scrutiny would not be appropriate because, again, this is not a circumstance of a ban. It's a commercial regulation. And secondly, it focuses on 18 to 20-year-olds who historically were not persons, adults within the core of the Second Amendment right.
Okay, and give us your two-sentence intermediate scrutiny here. So we've passed my whole conundrum about 18 to 20, and we're to the point that this is, they have these rights and they're being restricted in some way. Give me what you think the best argument is on your intermediate scrutiny.
Well,
you win.
The government interest at stake here is public safety, which the Supreme Court and this court have recognized is compelling. And then under intermediate scrutiny, this regulation is obviously substantially related to that public interest because Congress has focused here on what it found to be a major source of firearms, of handguns that were misused, that are disproportionately used in violent crime by an age group that is disproportionately represented in violent crime statistics.
Okay, I think we have it. Thank you. Mr. Cooper?
Thank you again, Your Honor. Before I address your point, Judge Haynes, let me just elaborate slightly on what my friend for the government was saying about the Militia Act of 1792. It does indeed have some exemptions from the enrollment requirement, from the militia duty requirement. Exemptions for the Vice President of the United States, the officers, judicial, and executives of the government of the United States. It goes on to list several other offices and positions. And it says they're exempted from militia duty, notwithstanding that they are between the ages of 18 and 45. This has nothing to do with the idea that people above the age of 18 but under the age of 21 were exempted in 1792. Your point, Judge Haynes. It's very important to understand the sheer gravity of the government's arguments to you today. Because there is no case from anywhere that we've been able to find where an individual, fundamental, enumerated constitutional right has been held to have a different or diluted or some reduced effect or protection between adults depending upon the age of the adult. That there is no case for that. And just think about the implications of that. Would we say that 18 to 20-year-olds can have a diluted or reduced right to speak or to worship or to confront witnesses against them or to have the protection of the Eighth Amendment?
Where do we draw that line? Because none of those amendments draw any kind of line between adult and children. Children have First Amendment rights. They don't have a First Amendment right to dance topless as opposed to somebody who is of age does within certain parameters.
There are many cases for the proposition that while children have constitutional rights, they may have lesser constitutional rights.
Define that line? That we're back to my initial question. I mean, I'm frankly struggling with this, so I don't want you to think I've already made up my mind, but I'm struggling with the fact that we have had this kind of angst around these 18 to 20-year-olds so that you can sign contracts, join the military, but not walk into a bar. And that's our current world right here in Texas.
And the line between those two hypotheticals, Judge Haynes, is not whether the individuals are minors or adults. It's whether or not the right that they're asserting is a fundamental, enumerated, individual right. There is no right to drink. If the age of drinking is adjusted above the age of majority, it need only satisfy rational basis. But that is not true of a fundamental individual right.
Can Mississippi, which has the age of majority as 21, can they, and I don't know, I've never tried, but can they have a rule that says you can't buy Playboy magazine until you're 21? Because that's infringing on a First Amendment right, and yet they have an age of majority of 21, and I don't know, I've never tried to buy any such product in Mississippi or elsewhere, but...
And Your Honor, I don't think they could. I don't think they could. Because I do believe that, for example, the Supreme Court's decisions with respect to whether or not you can...
up until, the 1970s where they started making everything 18, everybody was violating the constitutional rights of 18 to 20-year-olds because I'm sure, I'm a little young to remember for sure, but I think probably the 21 was the age for a lot of that stuff.
It was.
Buying Playboy magazine, et cetera, that might infringe on certain constitutional rights. So do we have 200 years of civil rights violations of 18 to 20-year-olds?
No, Your Honor. We don't. We do have, at least in 1968, we had then and there a violation. violation of the rights of the 18 to 20-year-olds with respect to acquisition of firearms. This statute was unconstitutional at the time because of the history specific to the ratification of the Second Amendment. But until the 1970s, the age of majority, the age at which it was appropriate for legislators, possibly, to make a distinction between minors and adults for purposes of their individual constitutional rights, was 21. That has changed. That has changed. And when that changed, Your Honor, the full panoply of constitutional rights carried with it the age of majority. So, in sum, I have two dispositive arguments. One, the history of the amendment itself, which set 18 as the critical and dispositive age. The other one is they're adults. Thank you.
Thank you. I thank both parties here for really